In today's episode of Telemetry Now, we are back at it again, talking about AI, except this time, instead of algorithms and models, we're laser-focused on networking, specifically data center networking for AI training workloads, how it's really an entirely new beast of networking when you compare it to traditional DC networking and even high-performance computer networking, if you have experience with that. So with me today is returning guest Chris Kane, who is an engineering leader at Arista. And we're going to be diving into what's near and dear to my heart, moving packets super fast, reliably, and efficiently to make the magic of AI happen. My name is Philip Gervasi, and this is Telemetry Now. Hey, Chris, thanks so much for joining the podcast today. It's great to have you on. Actually, it's great to have you on again because we had you on, along with Jason Ginnert, just a few weeks ago or a month ago, something like that, to talk about the USNUA. So this is a great class reunion for sure.
Absolutely. Thanks. I appreciate the opportunity, Phil. We could probably have a get-together every other week at the rate of technology evolution right now. We could get together at a regular cadence just in an attempt to keep up. If you weren't at GTC last week, there was one of the NVIDIA VPs of infrastructure was given a presentation, one of the sessions, and she had up there the Red Queen effect from Lewis and Carroll's Through the Looking Glass. Where the concept there is you have to run at full tilt, right? You have to run at full speed just in an attempt to stay in the same place. And I think that was very accurate as to kind of the workload we're all under right now.
Yeah, that is very true. It's something that I experience day in and day out right now, trying to keep up with, you know, the latest models, the latest changes on the networking side with regard to training models, what's happening with all of the adjacent technology in the AI space, trying to find the niche of, you know, use cases and the applicability of artificial intelligence to the NetOps space and really working through that, which I still think is in progress. So there is just so much. And then not only that, Chris, I am very much involved with studying like traditional data engineering right now, because that is like the vast majority of the activity that happens within an AI initiative. So I have been just studying data pipelines and transformation and all how to do all that stuff and storage and all that, just because I find it to be critical in understanding how then to, you know, apply these kind of technologies into network operations and how to not fail and have the never-ending POC, right? You know, that POC that just doesn't go anywhere because it's just too much of a lift to actually go into production. So can't keep up. But at the same time, I love it. I love it because it feels like it's something new I can finally latch on to. Like, do we really have to talk about BGP more? Maybe I shouldn't say that on a
networking podcast. No, you're absolutely right. And it's I've talked to people about this over the last couple of years. I've been very much a network engineer through and through. But in these environments, you've got to pull back. You've got to recognize what's happening with the compute, with the storage, with the power. Like, you really, it's the entire data hall, right? You really do need to have an appreciation for everything that's changing there. And I've come to start calling the half-life of this about 6 months. You've got to stay on top of it because within about a year, some of the approaches and strategies do roll over. So it's kind of back to the Red Queen effect and taking it all in.
So let's focus in on the networking piece. I mean, you mentioned power and cooling, and there's the actual overall architecture and how we're going to design racks moving forward and things like that. I get all that. And I was at DCD Connect in New York, where those were very top of mind for a lot of people. Really interesting stuff. But so was networking. Because as you know very well, but for our audience's edification, there are a couple of things to consider here. Number one, I don't know if this is still true, but for a while, the statistic was that 30 to almost 50% of a AI training job was time spent in networking, packets in networking. Maybe it's a little bit different now, but that was the number for a while. And so the network, because we are talking about distributed compute in order to make this magic happen. So the network is more critical than ever to artificial intelligence job training, model training, to job completion and to doing it efficiently in a way that makes sense. And not just training, but also inference, of course, as well. So there's that, which we'll talk about. So I want to get into that first, Chris. Why is data center networking for artificial intelligence unique and different than traditional networking? And if I can put a finer point on it, maybe even different than HPC, high performance computing networking?
Yeah, that's a good call out. It is different than HPC, but yeah, and you'll hear people talk about it's very compute intensive, it's very data intensive, but I think I'm not sure that those descriptions land. So if we take a step back for a minute and try to think about what these data scientists are trying to accomplish and what they would like to have, I like to paint a picture. Imagine you're walking into an empty data center, just completely empty. It's like a 50,000 square foot data center. You know, the walls are like 125 feet by 125 feet, completely open. And then if you could picture kind of at eye level, this huge processor, just one big ginormous processor that's so big it touches all four walls, right? It reaches clear across the entire room. And then above that, if you could picture a similar shelf where it's just one big, huge chunk of memory, right, laying equal size and equal density there above that ginormous processor, right? And then you picture connectivity paths or interconnects between that ginormous processor and that huge chunk of memory, right? That's what they'd like to have. That would be the ideal situation for them. And obviously, even with, you know, companies like Cerebras that has the wafer scale engine, we're not capable of building something just simply that big for them. So the next best thing is to build these clusters. And then by the very, you know, definition of that term cluster, we have to consider that, hey, I've got one of these things and somehow I've got to wire it up to 99,999 other ones, right, for the 100,000 size clusters that we have today. But, you know, anyone that followed GTC last week and they showed how they intend to build, you know, we're going to go from servers to whole racks, right? These are entire systems where you're going to have a rack or now possibly even two racks, where the concept is the servers are on line cards or they're on shelves, and the networking's similar, where it's on like a line card, and you're going to slide those line cards in and out of these racks, if you will, that are just going to be ginormous. That one that with the intent of coming out in what is it the second half of 2027 with Kybar. You know, 600 kilowatts of power required for that ginormous system. So you start off with this idea of, hey, we want to cluster these things together, but understand that it's not just the average data center where a system might talk to another system occasionally. This is more like synchronized swimming, right? Where everybody's got to work in unison, everybody's got to pull their weight, and it all has to happen in real time, right? And they've talked a lot lately about the increased compute capacity that we're going to need as we move into training and as you move into things like the agentic AI and the intents that they have with things like robotic AI, where it's got to be real time. And so they envision that we're going to need about 100 times the compute capacity that we even have right now. So hopefully that paints this picture of, hey, I've got a data center. All these things have to be cabled together. But the expectation is that they're not talking to each other incidentally or infrequently. They're synchronized, right? And they have to work in unison to complete those jobs.
So synchronous communication for GPUs talking to each other. And then there's going to be, I understand, model training clusters or pods of GPUs that then will send that result of that computational activity to another pod to do something with. So there's these large flows as well. So there's a couple of things that this suggests to me. One, the synchronous activity, because you said the word real time, and I know in networking it's always quote unquote real time, right? It's near real time as you can get, because there's always a problem with loss latency jitter. So I have to assume that, and that's always been a thing in data center networking. That's always been a thing in high end data center networking, lossless connectivity and all these things. But Ethernet is inherently lossy, and there are problems with load balancing and, you know, oversubscription of links and things like that. So how What are the specific problems that we need to solve? I mentioned a few, and I know we're going to talk about those. This kind of data center networking, and how are we solving them? Why don't we go into that?
Yeah, I'd say over the last 2 years, a big focus has been on the load balancing aspect. So if stepping back and thinking about how we connect these together, yes, there's, a bit still of a discussion back and forth about Ethernet versus IB. InfiniBand's not going to go away. It's still going to be here. I think, though, as we build these clusters bigger and bigger and ever bigger, and we go from one data hall to another, right, we're getting to the point where some of these clusters, it's not applicable to everybody, but some of these clusters are so big they can't fit in a data center. We've got to have a campus, and we've got to connect them together. Right. So and you'll see Ethernet leveraged more and more there. So I think that the industry predictions from Del Oro and 650 Group and others has been, hey, Ethernet port shipments are going to go way up. Right. It's not that IB is going to stop. It's just that Ethernet will eventually exceed the number of Ethernet ports deployed in these environments.
Maybe for more greenfield deployments, things like that. Yeah. So moving forward, it'll be the dominant for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. And when you roll these out, you also have to think in symmetry. So we have to have symmetry everywhere. And that actually came up again, another topic that was discussed at GTC last week was a focus of symmetry, even in memory. And because I need to have symmetry in memory, I'm unlikely to mix and match generations of accelerators inside of a single cluster. And so for the network, what that symmetry means is we need to have the exact same number of links and the exact same bandwidth from the leafs to the spines. And in the case of the bigger builds, if you're at a three-tier class network, you're going to aim for similar symmetry from the spines to the super spines. And at least from the leaf to the spines, we're doing something a little different than you and I grew up with, which was oversubscription. The next thing beyond trying to deal with load balancing and attack that with symmetry and attack that with some enhancements to Ethernet, and then a couple vendors are going to have their own little twist on that and how they do bit spraying. But the next thing to deal with is that, you really need no oversubscription whatsoever between the leafs and the spines. So you're going to match every bit of bandwidth that you connect down to those accelerators. You're going to match that one for one between the leaf and the spine. So then now we're into this realm of I have to have a ton of connections. I have to have a ton of cables or a ton of optics, right? And so the beyond load balancing, which I think we're pretty close to solving, I think everybody's got something in flight now or already available to address the load balancing challenge. The next one is, with its sheer number of interconnects that we have, what do you do to help minimize disruption of service when it comes to link flaps? Link flaps has been a huge problem. And there's a couple ways to address that. One is with the over-provisioning, just throw more of them out there to help with that. Another approach could be, what do we do with lasers and the reliability of what's happening with the actual optics themselves? That are an approach there. And then another part of it kind of gets into your realm of things is the importance of visibility. Right. And how am I monitoring this? How do I know exactly? How do I detect a problem? What do I do? Do I take immediate remediation action? In some cases, a loss of a link or a loss of an accelerator will equate, hey, pull the whole node out of the job. Right. Because it's better just to remove that by, the way the job is configured. It's better to remove that entire host than it is maybe to keep it limping along with one less GPU there as a resource that's available. So links and focusing on is I think really where I feel most of the industry is focused right now. It's a lot of discussion around observability and visibility because even if we take smaller numbers, let's forget the 100,000. That just doesn't apply to all of us. So let's say if you were to build a cluster of 2,000 GPUs, you're talking about 2,000 NICs that need 2,000 cables or optics, right? And then on the leaf side, the other end of that, I need 2,000 optics, right? Or the other end of those cables at the leaf. And then from the leaf to spine, rinse and repeat. I need to match that one for one. So I'm going to have 2,000 interfaces, optics, transceivers, cables between the leafs and the spine. So it quickly adds up when you say, hey, I'm aiming to do a cluster of 2,000, right away, okay, I've got 4,000 to 6,000 optics, right, that I could be dealing with in an environment just for that cluster. And so when someone comes up to you and says, hey, I'm struggling with this job, it's running slower than it ran the last time, could you troubleshoot it? It could be a needle in a haystack. I mean, it could be really hard to understand. Well, we have 2,000 resources here. Which of the 2,000s are you using for this job? Then that tells me, you know, which interfaces to look at or which leaves or spines to begin troubleshooting. So that visibility piece, you know, near real time based on streaming and how do we react to those problems so that we minimize the job disruption.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the speed is always, you know, top of mind for a lot of engineers, talking about 400, 800 gig, and then moving into, you know, 1.6 terabits per second is what I'm hearing coming down the pike not too long from now, and reading some stuff from the Ultra Ethernet Consortium. Really neat. But it really isn't just about speeds and feeds. It really is, you know, reducing that job completion time and addressing those drop packets, which can compound exponentially, you know, really, really hosing a training run. It really is about lossless connectivity. It really is about making the most of every single link available, as you said, with load balancing and being efficient as possible. And you mentioned link flapping. You know, having optics now, this many optics, and not only the optics, but the associated cables and NICs and all that. There's just so many points of failure. So we're seeing things of like low power optics, and then options that remove optics from the equation altogether. But over many years ago, I mean, we had InfiniBand, which was very high bandwidth, inherently lossless, right? And inherently, you know, had no issues with latency. And it was, you know, centralized. You had the subnet manager that you installed as software on one of the switches or whatever. And it was great for high performance computing. So what's the problem with InfiniBand moving forward? Now, I kind of already know the answer. I just did a debate with somebody on this, and we ended up both agreeing that Ethernet's moving forward, or rather we're moving forward with Ethernet because of these reasons. But I'd like to hear from you, since you are in the weeds with customers doing this every day.
Yeah, I think there's two, you know, there's one that's directly technical and maybe one not so much. But I, again, you know, huge respect for InfiniBand and its place. And, you know, but there is a difference between the use of InfiniBand when we talk about the difference between an HPC shop and like a true AI-based or AI factory is we're wanting to call these things now. But you know, you saw the focus, the co-packaged optic, the CPO made available right away on the Quantum line from NVIDIA as an example, with something similar coming to the Spectrum line, the Ethernet line, I think later next year. Other vendors are doing LPO or LRO or LDO. You'll see that represented a couple different ways. And we could talk in a little bit about, you know, specifically what those gains are. But I think part of the problem is just the number of engineers out there that are understand InfiniBand at all, right? And the human resources that we have that can design and build these and operate. You know, it's one thing to design and build it in the scheme of a network or the life of a network. That's about 5 minutes worth of work, right? I mean, the real meat of this is in the operations, the day two, as we say. And so the lack of engineering familiarity, the lack of tooling that's out there that's familiar with IB, and then there's the more technical aspects of it, which are around scaling. And as we get bigger and bigger, that, you know, how well, just leaving that question out there, how well does InfiniBand, as it is today, how well does it scale to the idea of supporting 100,000, 200,000, 300,000? And there's no let up with this idea. There's a goal of 1 million endpoints in these clusters. Like they started talking about that last year, and they haven't let that go. There still seems to be this march towards getting to 1 million. So, yeah. what we're leveraging a lot is, you know, if we could live vicariously through the CSPs, the CoreWeaves, the Googles, the Metas, and others that are building infrastructures this big, and the lessons they're learning, and for them to be able to say, hey, if I build a cluster of 26,000. GPUs together with InfiniBand, and then I put that side by side with 26,000 of Ethernet, you know, what does that look like? Can I survive on Ethernet? Is it as good or is it good enough? And, you know, in production, right, truly out there moving production packets, we have some of those cloud service providers that have been very transparent that, yeah, Ethernet's just fine. Like, we know its weak spots. We know where it's at today. We know how to tweak that and manage that. And then we expect it to become more plug and play as folks like the UEC, right, the Ultra Ethernet Consortium, help us with transport protocols, putting some more smarts in the NICs that are involved in these environments. So I think that'll close the gap of some of the performance differences between Ethernet and IP. And then going back to the original piece, there is the network engineer awareness and experience with the technology. You know, the network engineers are going to inherit these, are going to say, hey, I'd much rather have Ethernet. I understand it. I know it. My tools already know it. My team staffed up for it. In the world of automation, we already understand that, right, as we try to increase our network automation. So I think ultimately it's just the scale that catches up to us, whether that's the scale of one cluster or that's the scale of, you know, on the planet, how many of these clusters in total get deployed.
Right. I agree with the day two operations aspect and then the overall and long-term total cost of ownership and of operations for a data center network that's doing this. And if engineers that know InfiniBand that well are far fewer, like you said. But not only that, you know, who's running an InfiniBand front end network? Nobody. It's almost always, so you're now deploying gateways. You're now managing different networks and with the way that things are going. And I do know that it is very difficult to do these kinds of bake-offs where you can say, let's do a real, real detailed scientific perf test, performance test, and see what's better. And there aren't that many to look at. But I do know, like, for example, Meta did that with Llama 2, I believe, I think.
Right.
And they did a bake-off, and the performance differences between Ethernet and InfiniBand at that time were negligible, statistically zero. Though that's not officially zero, because as you scale up to very large, those kind of very, very small differences actually can be highly impactful. But I'm going to say, throwing a number out there, that that's like 2% of AI workloads. The vast majority are the performance of Ethernet is 100% fine. Not only that, it really is synonymous and probably outperforms InfiniBand in some ways. I get that there's some complexity there that, if you're doing just like a pure no configuration bake-off, you're going to have some trouble because Ethernet is inherently lossy. I get that. But, you know, with things like PFC, ECN, we don't have adaptive routing like we have in InfiniBand. There's things there. And so there's like these QoS components we have to add. But whatever, we know that stuff. That's kind of understood technology. And it solves that problem. And I feel like the cost of adding that little bit of complexity is well worth the benefit, considering that we still have 800 gig Ethernet and, you know, terabit Ethernet coming, just like, it's still keeping pace with what we need for bandwidth. And because it's a ubiquitous technology, all those reasons. And here's one that we didn't mention. You aren't locked into one vendor. Vendor. I personally don't think that that's like the end of the world, though, because I don't know about you, Chris, but when I was designing and building networks, including data centers, nobody cared about being multi-vendor. Like being like completely vendor agnostic wasn't a thing. It was always in a blog post or a podcast. We want to be vendor agnostic. And then I talked to customers, big customers, and like, no, we don't want that. We have, you know, operations and TAC and documentation. We want one vendor. What I found was that a lot of my customers wanted a single vendor for like the data center and perhaps a different vendor for security and a different vendor for campus, different vendor for wireless. They were agnostic in like these network blocks, not like switch by switch in their data center. I never saw any appetite for that ever.
Right.
That was just my experience.
But. No, you're not far off. I mean, some people might call those, you know, infrastructure silos or networking silos for those different areas of the
With InfiniBand, you are locked into a single vendor. And if that's a problem for you, then, well, that's a problem for you.
Well, and I think some of that might be a hangover from, you know, supply chain issues recently, right? In the not too distant past, I'd like to be able to get equipment from more than one organization. And then, you know, Gartner and others, I think there were philosophies at one point about, leveraging one vendor against another, right, to drive down your cost, ideally, as you negotiate with your account team. But yeah, you don't want to pick on InfiniBand for being, you know, proprietary just from one vendor. But I think just in general, betting against Ethernet, it's been proven to not be a good bet. If you look at, you know, we have precedent of what Ethernet has been able to absorb. So if you think about, hey, IP telephony, right? We're talking to each other. We're doing video right now. It's IP packets. It's predominantly over Ethernet. Videos, you know, if you watch the Summer Olympics last year, the majority of that broadcast has moved, or it has been moving to video, or excuse me, to Ethernet for some time now. This is just another one that you can roll in, right? And each time, I think Ethernet's had to adapt. There's been little changes. Hey, you know, adjust the transport protocol, do a little more work with the QoS, or change our QoS algorithms, perhaps, to deal with those, give them strict priority for the voice traffic. So it's adjusted, right? It hasn't necessarily been ready to absorb it right away. But with all of those laid out as a precedent of, hey, we've seen this before. Something comes along, Ethernet just kind of expands itself and its capabilities, and it's able to swallow that next technology up.
Yeah, and I really do believe that the little bit of complexity that's added in configuration in you know, making Ethernet work the way we want it to work for this particular use case more than outweighs the benefits. I really believe that, and that's why one of the reasons that I think InfiniBand Ethernet is the way moving forward.
Yeah.
Which is not my opinion. That's kind of the consensus in the industry.
It is, and I mean, well, and I really appreciate the work by Del Oro, and I recall, you know, they put out a report last fall where they had predicted a crossover in the number of ports shipped, right, where Ethernet would exceed IB. And I think originally that was expected to be like in maybe 2028. And then just 4 months later in February this year, there's a new report that comes out and they're like, we need to pull that in. This is accelerating. And so they pulled it in by like a year and at the prediction of when that crossover occurs. So I think it's going to continue to be pulled in. There's no end in sight here. We're, again, Red Queen effect. We're running as fast as we can. And things are coming out very quickly. So I think I think that crossover will happen sooner than you know, maybe even the industry or some of the industry experts to pay attention to those things will have predicted to occur.
Yeah.
You know, but all the talk about the QoS and PFC and ECN, and I think that's where you'll see a lot of vendors coming out with enhancements. And this, to me, this comes back to why I want every network engineer to be excited about this. I mean, I'm jazzed because I'm lucky enough to be around or adjacent to a lot of these projects. But with these kind of pressure cooker situations where you're solving problems never seen before, you're building networks of sizes we've never built before. Nobody has this all figured out. We are, you know, okay, we know what it takes to get it to work at 30,000. Now we know what it takes to get it to work at 50,000. Hey, here's some adjustments to get 100,000 GPUs working together. Out of that's going to come enhancements that every average network engineer is going to benefit from. So you mentioned having to tweak QoS, PFC or ECN or some of the other things. You already see from multiple vendors fabric solutions that have come out now, right? Like MIMPort in the case of Arista, right? We've done that. Juniper's done that, where there's more of a plug and play approach to it where, hey, okay, now that we know that these are the things you need, let's put some defaults in. Let's make some of this easier. Let's see how much of the network can configure itself as you get started, right? So we're trying to work on minimizing those touch points that you need to hit when you build it. And I think even more important, again, back to day two, lasting forever, we don't want you to have to tweak over and over again down the line, right? As these jobs change, as the workloads change, as we see differences in communication libraries, we're already hearing about those. You know, NVIDIA talks now not only about NICL, but about NIXL, right? NIXL. Where in the inference world, they're probably going to be using different communication libraries than what they've used in the training world. So you'll see vendors helping with that. As these lessons are learned, features will be developed. And ideally, hopefully, your networking vendor just makes that available to you, right? Hopefully, it's not some special one-off piece of hardware or special one-off piece of software that's just aimed at, you know, towards the cloud service providers or the neo clouds, but benefits that hit everybody. So, and I think that'll happen in your space too, right? And in monitoring and visibility stuff, it's like, hey, as we get better and understanding that we need to watch for, queue drops? Do we need to pay attention to how long we're queuing a packet before it actually makes it to that egress port? That added visibility that then ultimately ought to end up being some automation too, some automation, some AI ops type stuff in the network that we could take advantage of. It really puts shines a spotlight on the visibility and operation side of things.
Sure, sure. I actually think that's one of the easiest, and that's not the right word, but I think that's a great use case for AI in network operations, at least a starting point. Obviously, there's management, there's a lot of things that you can do. I also think it's ironic that we're talking about training AI models and the network is so important, yet it like doesn't even take advantage of the model that it
just That's true. Not enough yet. No, yeah, right. Shame on us. We're so busy trying to build these things and focus on the solutions.
Well, but applying AI to network operations is tough because, we deal with, like we've discussed, near real-time telemetry, such a variety of telemetry in visibility and observability. But I do think that that's one of the a great use case to start with, simply because, it is a practice in data engineering and data science and data analytics. And so, ingesting data and then using AI models or even just statistical analysis algorithms and ML models, applying that to get some insight, understand things at a scale that we really can't do manually, I think that makes a lot of sense as a first step. And so you don't need to get scared of like, oh, I'm going to hand the actual management of my network over to some team of AI agents and then lose all control and all these kind of things, which is cool if that happens down the road, fine. But right now, today, I think starting with things like just getting information and then being able to analyze it properly at great, great scale and at greater depth and insight than we have before, I think is a great use case for AI in NetOps. But what do you think then is the near future of data center networking for these kind of workloads? What do you think that looks like? We could talk about the Ultra Ethernet Consortium, of course. And you talked about how every 6 months there's pretty much a revolution of technology. So let's stay in the near term. What are you seeing happening with conversations with customers and in your own research and reading?
Yeah. So you're going to hear, if you haven't already, you're going to hear more about scale up versus scale out. That was emphasized at GTC last week. And that's been brought up, I'd say, I feel like since about Q3, Q4 last year, people have been talking about that a little bit more. And in order to build these systems to respond in the way that we want them to, a lot of times that's going to have to be a focus on scale up. So in the case of scale up, you're going to hear a lot about proprietary solutions and then industry, vendor agnostic solutions. You're going to hear about UALink and UXL and CXL and a lot of things that are happening inside of, what's moving from a system to moving to a rack. So instead of just having, hey, here's a server with 8 GPUs in it that need 8 400 gig connections, or later this year, we're anticipating the 800 gig NICs to be available. And then you mentioned 1.6 terabit. I think we'll see that probably mentioned or maybe slightly available at the end of this year, but probably really more of the focus of next year for wide availability of 1.6 terabit interfaces. So the UEC is going to help on the scale out side. So scale up, what's happening in these racks or multiple racks that are clustered together, and then scale outs, how I get across the entire data center, and then subsequently for the ones that are just doing the crazy builds, how do I get multiple data centers on the same campus to be working? I think other areas to keep an eye on are what are happening with the interconnects inside of these systems, because as a network engineer, even when we're not directly responsible for something, we sure do spend a lot of time helping people troubleshoot and pinpoint where a problem is, right? I mean, if something written on a wire is incredibly important to us, we have that visibility, Wireshark is your friend. And I think understanding that we need to apply that even to the interconnects between, the GPU to GPU communication, the GPU to memory, the GPU to CPU, and those little other networks that are running inside of these systems. Like in the case of NVIDIA, you've got your NVLink you should be aware of. In the case of AMD, the Xfinity. You have your PCIe. They're working to increase speeds for PCIe for us, right? And then you get outside the host, right? And then you get from leaf to spine or from nick to leaf.
Right.
And so I think, you know, focusing on those. Another area that is right around the corner, you saw the CPO announcement, the co-packaged optics announcement from Quantum or from NVIDIA for their Quantum line, their IB line. You're going to see other vendors coming out with co-packaged optics. You're also going to see an alternative to that where you'll see it as either LDO or LPO. Linear drive optics, where it's a similar concept, but believed to be more serviceable. Ultimately, what's happening there is the brains of the optics are being moved inside to the silicon, to the switch ASIC itself. And that gains us a couple things. We've been talking about power, right? Power is killing us in these environments. A lot of data centers built yesterday do not have the power, to say nothing of getting ready for liquid cooling. And so if you move the brains of that transceiver into the silicon, then I don't need as much power for that component. And then also, without the brains being there, I help on that latency discussion. I could go from maybe a ballpark of 100 nanoseconds per transceiver in a path down to about 1 nanosecond relative for that transceiver. So we have a huge gain in both speed and power, which is what everybody's, you know, bigger, better, faster, more. It's what everybody's after.
Right.
So I think keeping an eye out is maybe you don't have a project right now, but doing the homework on CPO and LPO and just what's available from your preferred networking vendors and what that means to you as you build these. You've got to keep going back to, this is not your average data center. I'm not plugging this into my existing data center connectivity that's 25 gig or 100 gig, right? We've already talked about 8 GPUs in one of these nodes means I've got likely either 4 or 8 400 gig connections I'm being asked for. Then you add the CPU at 25 to 100 gig, or then you add storage at 200 to 400 gig. Quickly, you realize, holy cow, we're like 12 connections or more for every one of these servers that show up, and they're incredibly high speeds, right? And then you get into, you know, if you haven't studied or learned about the front end versus the back end, there's some things here you could, from the industry, you could really be doing due diligence on right now to get an understanding so that you don't feel overwhelmed when these projects actually do land on your desk, right? The network engineer is only one step better than security, I think, in a lot of projects, in that, you know, we're next to last to hear about these projects. We're not often engaged early. And so to minimize that shock and the homework you'll have to do, I think paying attention to general industry updates like CPO and LPO and the 400 gig, the 800 gig, what those mean, you know, doing that homework now in preparation for their arrival will help. And just one more thing in that area, doing the homework, I would mention, I feel like this is similar to the automation story that we see playing out. Phil, I don't know how it is with your customers, but with mine, let's say I have a network team of 7 folks, right? Not all 7 become automation gurus, at least not that I've seen. Typically what happens, there's 1 or 2 people on that team that gravitate towards the automation. It just makes sense to them. They fall in love with it. They start playing around with it. And then they're doing the automation work for the entire team, right? And you find the other 5 folks bringing ideas to them, and then the 2 automation specialists roll it out. I think this is similar. This is so different than the average network. There's just so much to be aware of. The compute, the storage, the memory, the jobs, that I think on these teams, you're probably going to find 1 or 2 people that gravitate towards it. Let them do this homework now, right? Because you'll be better served doing that due diligence now than in a scramble at the last minute, just hoping your vendor can design something, you know, appropriate for you. So in that case, I feel a little comfort that automations are kind of shown us how that works, right? That we kind of understand, hey, when there's something entirely new that we're trying to merge in here, that maybe the entire team doesn't have to take that on. We could just designate a couple specialists and let them run with it.
Yeah. And you bring up a couple points. I mean, there is one thing you mentioned is that there's a difference between the networking happening in between 2 GPUs and then between switches and then between entire pods of GPUs and another pod or cluster of GPUs, right? And then between a front end and a back end, between the storage network and the, you know, the actual computational activity that's happening. So those are all different like network blocks there within the data center now that we have to contend with and address. And you mentioned the changing nature of optics and protocols. We didn't discuss like RDMA, but that was like a solved problem. We had InfiniBand, RDMA, memory to memory. All our problems are solved. And we realized, well, not exactly. So we put that on Internet and we got Rocky, RDMA over converged Ethernet. Then we had a version 2 because we wanted routing and some other things. And so every time we solve a problem, we're like, all right, we're good. And then, you know, a few months later, we're like, we're not good. We need more. And so it's amazing to me how even in the networking space, it's true. It's being driven by the applications and by the artificial intelligence itself, the result and the use cases for it. It's not networking for networking's sake. We are supporting that. But it's right in line. The development in our niche of tech has been keeping pace right alongside with the latest model and DeepSeek R1. And then 10 minutes later, DeepSeek, you know, R3. And it needs this now. What about like new standards? You know, I know the UEC has been talking about the Ultra Ethernet Transport Protocol. Are you familiar with that at all?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, I think we're all anxious to see that roll out, get stamped, and get implemented. I think a lot of the enhancements will probably end up in the NICs. Right, it's not just the network switches and the network vendors that have to adjust. I think they're pretty ready for it. A little bit of software change, I think, is all they're going to need. So I think networking vendors are going to be able to absorb those recommendations and newer transport formats and some updated protocols for us. It'll be more probably. I think the heavy lift is aimed towards the NICs themselves. But yeah, again, that's, you know, these are enhancements. These are things that are going to make Ethernet better across the board. It's not like Ethernet's just, you know, going to be solely aware of, you know, that this is RDMA traffic versus, you know, whatever the web or SIFS traffic or, you know, whatever you normally see in your environment. There's just this, you know, crucible of demand on Ethernet that it's not just the UEC, right? That'll be a part of enhancing Ethernet for us, right? The individual networking vendors are going to come up with hopefully interoperable, not proprietary solutions there as well. And hey, how great to see NVIDIA join the UEC and NVIDIA join the Ethernet Alliance. I mean, that's another group that's a group I had never followed before. I attended a conference last fall, the Ethernet Alliance Forum. It was great to hear the SerDes engineers talk about how they're going from 224 gig to 448 gig, right? SerDes speed lanes to get us our 800 gig and 1.6 and ultimately 3.2 terabit interfaces. So it's going to come from a bunch of angles, not just the UEC.
Absolutely. And integrating with things like power and cooling and the build of the racks and everything, like we said. So it's amazing. It's an amazing time of these things coming together. So I'm looking forward to the speeds more than anything else, because as a traditional turner of a wrench, virtual and physical, and configuring routers and data centers in the cold and hot aisles, I love seeing those speeds. Yes, I get it. We want to eliminate out-of-order packets and drop packets and latency and all these things. I get it. But it is so cool to hear speeds like 1.6 terabits in my data center on this. You know, that's pretty amazing. I remember, in data centers jumping from 1 to 10 gigs and then 10 to 25 and to 40 and 100 and things, and like just being enamored with this and how they're never going to use this, thinking to myself as I'm designing this project. And now... the network really, really is the greatest potential of bottleneck than ever before. And I know, you know, there are times when compute was the bottleneck or storage or things like that, but it really does come down to networking because of the way these workloads happen today. So really interesting stuff.
You're spot on. Yeah, even with the NVL 576, right? The announcement that's a couple years out for those racks and the focus on scale up, you know, but that's still, if I could say this, that's still only 576. you know, you're going to end up with a lot of those cabinets still trying to talk to each other. So you're right. Scale out is still going to matter. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the excitement of being able to solve those problems and being involved around those projects and seeing that technology unfold. And again, even if you're not directly involved with them, the benefits that'll hit everybody, whether that's in the performance of your Ethernet switches, the configurations, the features that are available, but also the visibility, right? And the other benefits that I'll get that'll be applicable all over my infrastructure. I think we're blessed. I appreciate that this has happened. I mean, I really haven't seen this kind of energy and excitement around networking in what feels like a couple decades. So I think it's a boon to the Ethernet side of things as well.
And to a lot of industries and sub industries, obviously to switching manufacturers and all the adjacent manufacturers in the Ethernet world. But also, like you said, you mentioned visibility and observability several times. I mean, this is a new challenge and also critical to managing the operations of a data center today, these kinds of data centers. So, and as we know, the visibility and observability space is all about data. It's all about data pipelines and analytics and ingesting and figuring that stuff out without adversely affecting, without any performance penalty on the data center itself. And figuring that out is critical in making sure we reduce things like the job completion time and we address those link flaps and we understand where the elephant flows are and all that kind of stuff. And we can continue to empower the latest and greatest model, the latest and greatest model training to happen. So, Chris, this has been a really interesting episode. I love this stuff. And I agree with you. It is really cool to be able to talk about cool new things happening in networking specifically with moving packets, old school networking, but in the new age. Really fun. So thanks so much for joining me today.
Yeah, thanks, Phil. Appreciate it. And I look forward to the next chat.
Absolutely. So if you have an idea for an episode or you'd like to be a guest on Telemetry Now, I would love to hear from you. You can reach out to us at telemetrynow@kentik.com. So for now, thanks so much for listening today. Bye-bye.